Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Marriage Box by Corey Ajmi. Narrated by Cassandra Campbell. Prologue. The night started out like every Syrian Jewish wedding. The florist pinned white orchids around the huppah. Caterers folded yarmulkes into black half moons. A photographer snapped our picture. Me, 18 years old, in a high-neck, long-sleeved, Victorian-style wedding gown, nails polished rebel red. And Tracy, my best friend, in off-white satin, neckline plunging enough to make people stare.
Casey, you don't have to do this, you know, Tracy said.
While I'd spent the summer shopping for my trousseau and planning my wedding, Tracy had spent the summer getting ready for college, where she'd bar hop and dodge unwanted pregnancies. Now and then, she'd study. She couldn't understand why I was adhering to my family's expectations, marrying a Syrian Jew, shopping at Tiffany's for wine and water glasses, contentedly testing chicken and eggplant recipes dashed with allspice. Smile, the photographer instructed. Tracy looped her arm around my back.
You might as well smile now while you're still happy.
We posed in front of a 6-foot golden Jewish star.
Why can't you just live with him like every other normal American girl? This isn't 1882 Aleppo, it's 1982 America.
This isn't America, I said. It's Brooklyn. In the few years since my family had moved from New Orleans, returning to our roots in Brooklyn, I'd learned the hard way there were rules. A teenage girl was taught to dress for seduction, but was forbidden to have premarital sex. She couldn't date until she was 16, but had to be married by 18. And she certainly couldn't live with a man unless she was his wife.
And what's with your dress? Tracy went on. Why do you pick something so virginal?
She used her fingers to form a halo over her head and smiled, posing for the camera. Hands on her hips, she looked at me.
You're doing exactly what you swore you wouldn't do. You said you didn't want to be like your mother who went straight from her father's house into her husband's. You said you didn't want to be like other Syrian girls who got married before they were of legal drinking age, before they had a driver's license.
I have my license, I said, turning from Tracy. The guests from New Orleans scoped out the Brooklyn synagogue like they were stepping on foreign soil. They'd never been to an Orthodox Syrian wedding, and you could tell from their faces, their foreheads crinkled, they were having a hard time accepting the idea of an 18-year-old getting married. Plus, the whole affair was kind of like Fiddler on the Roof spiked with lifestyles of the rich and famous, a party for 800 people where every woman in the room, regardless of age or religiosity, wore a skin-tight dress, size 2, and Christian Dior stilettos, dolled up like Barbie with long black hair. I was an exception with light hair and fair skin, forever sticking out. A blonde, my mother always said as if I were a foreign object, in this house. Unbelievable. Tracy stood by my side.
This is like the Twilight Zone. I can't believe you're getting married. Sadie, Sadie, married lady.
Tracy sang the Barbra Streisand lyric as a tall waiter in a black tuxedo walked by. He smiled at her. Tracy cupped her hand over her mouth.
He's cute, she whispered.
He is. Tracy wagged a finger at me.
Uh-uh. There'll be no more of that, young lady. Bye-bye to the good old days, I said, realizing I didn't know how to behave around cute single boys anymore.
Tracy smiled at our handsome waiter and took 2 shots of a rock off his silver tray. She handed me one.
Drink up, she said. You're going to need this. I want to get married. I want to do this,
I remember telling Tracy. But memory, like love, is fickle. It's true I thought my life would unfold like a romance novel, one scintillatingly evocative chapter after another. When you're 18,
You think your dreams are undeniable truths. At least I did. I had no clue my brain was still developing, or that during my first year of marriage, I'd grow an inch. New Orleans, 1980. On the morning of our move, I stayed in bed studying the details of my New Orleans room so I can remember them later when my family gets to Brooklyn. At night, my curtain rods create shadows long as Pinocchio's lying nose, and the wallpaper, too young for me at 16, is printed with little girls wearing bonnets and carrying umbrellas, strolling this way and that with no apparent direction at all. I step out of bed, curling my toes into the carpet, plush as a jazz fest lawn. I dress, not caring what I look like. On my way to the kitchen, I take in the sight of our pool table and etch it, too, in my memory. Will I remember the green top where my brother Sam and I sat and sprawled and played? The deep pockets? All the glistening balls? Or would I only recall how my father had the pool table delivered to our house without telling my mother, and how it sat anchored in our den like a large ship? The kitchen pantry is nearly empty. Preparing for our move, my mother let everything run out. No more Oreos, Pop-Tarts, Frosted Flakes, or Trix. All that is left is half a box of Captain Crunch. I sit down at the dinette table and pour chocolate milk thick as velvet into a bowl. Cereal bobs like a bunch of baby yellow life rafts. "I have to fix things, Elsie," I say to the cow pictured on the carton. "There's got to be a way to make things right." I drink the last bit of milk, carry the empty bowl to the sink, and let my hands linger under warm, soapy water. Through the window, I spot my parents in our driveway, jostling luggage, loading our car. When they finish, my father slams the trunk shut. He splays a road map across the hood, and my parents huddle over it. It is barely light outside, and my mother is already dressed. Perfectly fit, she wears a crop top and low-riding jean shorts. I slip a hand under my t-shirt and with a finger trace the scar on my stomach. Not wanting anyone to see it and humiliated about how I got it, I would never wear an outfit like my mother's. The plan is that my father and I will drive from New Orleans to New Jersey, where we will spend the summer in a rented house. My mother and Sam are traveling by plane. I wanted to go with them, but my father, still mad about what I've done and not wanting me out of his sight, said, "Cassandra, you're with me." Well, I never liked the sound of my full name. When my father said it, then, so full of disenchantment, it felt particularly off-putting. We leave New Orleans just after dawn. My mother and Sam stand as if in a police lineup, watching as my father backs our black Cadillac with cherry red leather seats out of our driveway. Tears well in my eyes as we pass our magnolia tree. It's overgrown and blocks much of our house. My father wanted to transplant it in our backyard, but didn't, because Mr. McKinley, our gardener, suggested we leave well enough alone. Magnolias have a hard time adapting. We drive down Canal Boulevard, a street that sways as if jazz beats below it. At a red light on Harrison Avenue, I glance at the library I spent hours in, learning the Dewey Decimal System and flipping through the card catalog, trying to locate my summer reading books. And my mind floods with memories of Tracy. Playing King of the Raft, riding our bikes for snowballs, sleepovers, gymnastics, watercolor painting, and hook rug classes. Even the time we got a week of detention for leaving school during lunch now feels like a fond memory. An orange sun threatens to rise in the distance, and I cry as my father speeds across the I-10. Wordlessly, we travel through Louisiana and Mississippi, stopping for gas whenever we run low. Gone with the Wind rests on my lap. I never thought of myself as someone who'd take things that didn't belong to me,
but with all that's happened, it doesn't seem to matter anymore. So on the last day of classes, I stole the novel from our high school library. It's not that I'm an avid reader. I just wanted something to connect me to the South and to my Madison prep classmates, who are smart, real smart, ferocious readers, winners of national essay contests and state science fairs. Madison Prep is considered to be one of the best schools in the city. But I never tried to get good grades. Maybe it's because my mother didn't care. "Just get C's," she'd say. "Just get by." But Madison Prep is a college preparatory school, and that distinction was key. Plus, the girls in my class were basically hairless with tiny pug noses, while I have hair on my arms and legs and above my top lip. My father turns on the radio. His purse is wedged between his thigh and the car door. Without taking his eyes off the road, he unzips it. He plops a piece of bubblicious shaped like a tiny pink brick into his mouth. I thought my father carrying a purse was the most humiliating thing ever, until the day he picked me up after school on his red motorcycle, wearing a shiny silver helmet and dark sunglasses. Mr. Marino, the headmaster, was out front, standing under the American flag, and he studied my father as if he'd encountered an alien from another planet. My father raises the volume on the radio when Queen's "Another One Bites the Dust" comes on. He drums on the dash and sings out loud, "Are you happy? Are you satisfied?" When I told Tracy we were moving, even though we hadn't talked for weeks because of what had happened between us, she said, "Who moves junior year? Nobody. Nobody moves junior year of high school. Tell them." But since my parents believe everything that has gone wrong in New Orleans is my fault, they aren't interested in my opinion. They want to move back to the community where they both grew up, back to a world that is safe and controlled. Stuck in some kind of weird time warp, Syrians follow Orthodox traditions, and my parents want that now. So instead of returning to a prep school in September, I'm enrolled in a yeshiva, a religious school, where boys and girls learn in separate classrooms. Every day, Sam will have to pray, thanking God he is male, and I will have to wear a skirt long enough to cover my knees. Tracy is going to freak out when she finds out that a girl's virginity is still valued like some kind of precious prize. My father swerves, avoiding roadkill, and Gone with the Wind falls to the car floor with a thud. I pick it up and place it back on my lap. Outside, the sun hides behind clouds, and I study license plates. In what seems to be never-ending time, I see plates from Tennessee, Arkansas, Colorado, even California. People from everywhere travel like free birds across our country. Air conditioning blows on my arms and legs, and I get goosebumps. Bringing my knees to my chest, I slide the vent closed.
"Are you cold?" my father asks, adjusting the temperature.
"I'm fine," I say. This is the first thoughtful thing he's said to me in weeks. Stretching, I rest my feet atop a box on the car floor. It contains knee-high purple boots, the ones Grandma Rose sent from New York.
"Isn't that just like your grandmother?" my mother said when the package arrived in the mail. "Not a practical bone in her body. Who cares if it's 100 degrees in New Orleans? Every girl must have plum-colored boots."
She lifted them from the box and looked at them up close. "I have to admit, they're stunning," she said. Later that night, alone in my room, I tried them on, prancing around in a bra and panties, modeling the boots in front of the full-length mirror behind my locked door. At Madison Prep, the kids in my class wore Lacoste and corduroy. I thought I'd never wear purple boots, ever. Turns out, teenagers have little say in their own lives, and who could have predicted I'd be leaving behind my preppy school, moving to New York, and bringing the boots with me?
My father changes the radio station and Diana Ross sings Upside Down. He taps a single finger against the steering wheel and blows a pink bubble. We still have a long way to go. Exhausted, all I want to do is sleep. I try to adjust my seat for more legroom, but can't. The back is crammed with cartons and bags full of our belongings. Our family photo albums, my mother's jewelry, my father's trophies, and his .38 caliber Smith & Wesson. The gun is in a box, jammed in a corner. Not wanting me to touch it during our journey, my father pointed it out, which was totally unnecessary because I always knew where he kept it. We are not the kind of family to own a gun. Most Jews don't. And my mother didn't want my father taking it with us to New York. She'd read a story in the newspaper. A woman had flown in from out of town to surprise her boyfriend on his birthday. She hid in his closet, and the birthday boy, not expecting anyone in his apartment, shot at the noise, accidentally killing her. But my father had been unwavering. New York is dangerous. I overheard him telling my mother, "This is the 80s. It's not like when we were growing up." He agreed to keep the gun unloaded, but for our own safety, he wouldn't leave it behind. Not wanting to think about violence, yeshiva, or this dumb move, I sandwich Gone with the Wind between my head and the window and close my eyes. New Orleans, 1976. I probably wouldn't have ended up in Brooklyn if it wasn't for my father's gun. He didn't even start out wanting it. But the year of the bicentennial, the year I turned 12, Bob Stein, Tracy's father, finagled a police badge from the mayor of New Orleans and had been showing off, claiming it was a lifesaver. It had come in handy, saved him a couple of speeding tickets, and my father wanted one too. After that, one thing just kind of led to another. Maybe that's how everything in life happens. The NOPD badge transformed my father into some kind of superhero. Fearless, while at his souvenir store in the French Quarter, almost daily he pinned shoplifters against the wall. "He's out of control," my mother said to her best friend, Susie Stein, Tracy's mother. She offered her milk for her coffee in our kitchen, poured coffee for herself, and sat down next to Mrs. Stein. "He's a big fish in a small pond," my mother said, insulting my father and the city of New Orleans simultaneously. My mother never liked New Orleans and had no idea she would end up living there. My father was set to work for her father, Grandpa David, in New York. But my father and Grandpa David didn't get along. Plus, there was an opportunity for him in New Orleans where his father, Grandpa Sam, lived. According to family lore, Grandpa Sam was supposed to be just passing through New Orleans after coming from Aleppo, but he fell in love with back of town, raw, smoky basements and jazz music. He found work peddling silk stockings to ladies of the night and eventually opened a store on Royal Street where he sold souvenirs. Seduced by all the glittery southern decadence, he treated my Syrian grandmother badly after marrying her and taking her away from her close-knit family in Brooklyn. They had three children, my father being the youngest, before my grandmother Cynthia moved back to Brooklyn, taking my father, at 5, with her. So even though my father adored community life, he needed to make a living, and the family business was in New Orleans. After a few robberies in our neighborhood, my father came to believe his badge wasn't enough. "What am I going to do? Flash it at a burglar?" No, he needed something more. That's when he came home with his gun. He extended his arms, revealing it to me and Sam. It shined smooth as an 8-ball. "I can't deal with this insanity," my mother said, sweeping her long black hair away from her face. "What kind of crazy city is this? You're not a cop, Stephen, are you?" She put her hands on her hips. "Are you a cop and I don't know it?" And probably because Live and Let Die was her favorite movie, she added in a British accent, "Maybe you're Bond, James Bond." "Very funny, Sharon." He turned from her and restored his gun to its brown leather case, fastening the safety strap around it. That summer, women's liberation was in full swing, and my mother wanted to be a part of it. She thought it was important to get a job. Mrs. Stein questioned my mother's decision to enter the workplace, reminding her that she still had two children to raise. My mother and Mrs. Stein deliberately got pregnant at the same time, and Tracy and I were supposed to be born back to back, practically twins. I was due first, but Tracy came out 3 weeks early, beating me into the world. My mother told Mrs. Stein she was making a big deal out of nothing.
"You act like I'm abandoning my kids."
Mrs. Stein just looked at her. "Stop it, Susie," my mother said. The next day, she put an ad for a housekeeper in the Times-Picayune, and a woman from Guatemala showed up for an interview. Her name was Nellie, and she followed my mother to the yellow velvet couch in our living room, telling her how she'd come to America craving a better life and how she'd left her family behind. She said she wanted to live with us and that we could be her family. My mother hired her immediately. I watched from the doorway as Nellie unpacked her bags in our guest bedroom.
"You can come in," she said, not looking at me.
I sat down at the foot of Nellie's bed while she set a statue of Jesus Christ on her dresser. I had never seen a statue like that before, and Nellie must have suspected I was curious about it because she turned and glared at me.
"These are my things," she said, struggling to speak English. "Don't ever let me see you touching my things."
Within a few days, my mother secured a job at NetSet in the Lakeside Mall, and she wore her work uniform, a white tennis skirt with an appliqued yellow ball on the pocket, with pride. As further proof of her commitment to the women's movement, my mother gave up her standing appointments at the John Jay Salon, cut her share-length hair short, and joined a new culture of women who thought, "Why bother?" My father was furious and viewed this act as deliberate and hostile.
"It's my hair," my mother said.
"I'm aware of that, Sharon, but I have to look at you."
My father believed American women had gone too far, and that it was a mistake to think looks didn't matter. He had his own idea of beauty, a Syrian man's expectation, and he was always saying that at the very least she could put lipstick on before he came home from work. The tension between my parents was high that summer. Things would start out fine and somehow end in disaster. One hot New Orleans day, my father suggested we go swimming. In the deep end, Sam did a cannonball, I did a jackknife. My father dove and glided through the water.
"Let's see who can hold their breath the longest," my father said when he came up for air.
The three of us formed a circle and dunked. I came up first, then Sam. My father stayed under. After what felt like a long time, he rose to the surface but floated face down. I tapped his shoulder and he didn't budge. Sam grabbed his arm.
"Daddy, the game's over."
"Help," I cried. "Help." My father sprang up with a roar and dug his fingers into my ribs.
"Stop it," I screamed.
He fastened my arms together, holding me tight, and put his face close to mine, scratching my cheek with his dark sideburns.
"You're my hostage," he said in a sinister voice. "I'll never let you go."
"What's going on out here?" my mother asked, opening the sliding door. "You know I hate teasing."
"We're just playing," my father said. "Come join us."
She was wearing a black bikini and she closed the door behind her.
"Oh la la,"
my father said, staring, and my mother blushed from his flirting. My father stepped out of the pool and wrapped a towel around his toned waist. He slid his bedroom door open, put on the radio, and turned up the volume. We had central air conditioning, and never careless, a genuine supporter of the Give a Hoot, Don't Pollute campaign, my mother asked him to close the door. My father wanted to hear the music and said it would be fine to leave it open for a few minutes. He smiled, took hold of her hand, and lifted her from the lounge chair. George Harrison's Give Me Love played in the background. Standing behind her, he danced and held her arms out to the sides like wings of an airplane. His towel fell as he wiggled his red Speedo bathing suit against her. Give me love, give me love, give me peace on earth, he sang. I sat dripping near the edge of the pool. My mother remained rigid, motioning at me with her chin.
It's okay, Sharon.
He spun her around and smiled.
Give me love, he sang,
as if there had never been a disparaging moment between them, as if he could simply move forward from this minute on in pure marital glee.
Let's have another baby.
What? Are you crazy?
He let go of her hands and stepped back.
Why is that crazy?
I just got a job. I'm just starting to live.
She sat back down, stretched her legs out on the lounge, and lifted her Good Housekeeping magazine. When she didn't look up, my father walked away. Even though my mother needed to keep my father at a safe distance, she didn't want to push him too far away, so for the rest of the day, she was attentive and kind. She made both tuna fish and egg salad for lunch and served mayonnaise on a plate instead of out of the jar. We sat outside at our round table under an umbrella. Wearing a black lace cover-up over her bikini, my mother held tongs and smiled.
Salad?
Her red lipstick shimmered. No, thank you, my father said, not looking at her. I'm not hungry. My mother turned her attention to me as if unaffected by his response.
Tuna or egg? She asked.
My parents were at it again, this game of theirs. I might as well have been invisible. After lunch, my mother went inside and took Sam with her.
It's too hot, she said, shutting the sliding door.
My father let his legs dangle off the edge of the diving board and dragged his big toe through the water. I sat next to him, my blonde hair in braids, my legs skinny as a chicken's. Side by side, our reflections rippled below. Neither one of us said a word. And then, just like that, my father snapped out of it, stood up on the diving board, held his fist to his mouth like a microphone, and sang, "When you were young and your heart was an open book, you used to say, live and let live." And he danced, putting on a show before he dove back into the water. Just then, our gardener, Mr. McKinley, unlatched the gate. He had his son with him, who was about my age. He was black, and I thought he was cute. Wearing my yellow bikini, I ran from one end of the pool to the other, and the flaps on my bathing suit fluttered like petals in the wind. This was when I still wore bikinis, before the scar on my stomach, before everything went bad. I jumped into the pool with my fingers closed around my nose, knowing the gardener's son was watching. I swam toward him. Sweat dripped from his cheeks. His eyes were dark pools of hope.
"Daddy," I whispered, "it's really hot. Do you think we could let that boy swim with us?"
At that time in New Orleans, it was unlikely to see blacks and whites mingling. But my father did the unexpected.
"Sure we can."
He climbed the pool steps and motioned for Mr. McKinley to cut the motor.
"How'd your boy like to swim? It's awfully hot out."
Mr. McKinley looked stunned.
"He won't be bothering you all none."
"Of course not," my father said, drying off. Beyond the patio, Mr. McKinley pushed his lawnmower over our grass, while his son stripped off his T-shirt and, still wearing his long shorts, treaded carefully into the shallow end. My father laid a towel across a lounge and slathered on bain de soleil.
"What's your name?"
I asked the boy.
"Quentin," he said, holding on to the side of the pool. "But everyone calls me Q."
"Should I call you Q?"
He nodded, moving toward the deep end, reaching hand over hand.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?